From Swarthmore College.
From Swarthmore College.
This is.
This is.
This is.
This is War News Radio.
I'm Kate Aronoff.
And I'm Anjali Kadambi.
This week on War News Radio, Left Behind, we hear about an American soldier missing in action.
On the night of October 23rd of 2006, I received a telephone call. And his mother was hysterical that her son was kidnapped.
Then, we debut a new media analysis series and explore the media coverage of the Pentagon report on Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
A policy or a law that, in effect, requires people to lie gives me a problem.
Finally, we speak with a veteran about his two tours in Iraq and about coming home.
But first, a roundup of this week's news.
Iraq has delayed its first nationwide census for the second time in two decades. Disagreements have arisen over who will do the counting in disputed northern areas, the semi-autonomous Kurdish regional government or Iraq's central government. The census will determine the ethnic makeup of these contested regions and could ultimately decide which group has jurisdiction over the territories. At the heart of the disagreement stands the city of Kirkuk, home to Arabs, Kurds, Turkmen, and other ethnic groups, which lies atop a third of the country's $11 trillion in oil reserves. No new date has been set for the census, which was originally supposed to take place on December 5th.
Iraqi forces stopped an attempted suicide car bomb attack against the French embassy in Baghdad this week. Brigadier General Ahmed Abu Reef reported that the group responsible for the plot was the Islamic State of Iraq, a Sunni extremist organization with ties to Al-Qaeda. The group is also responsible for last month's siege of a Christian church that killed more than 50 people and wounded over 60. Iraq's Interior Ministry stated that intelligence gathered from the 12 militants arrested this week in connection with the church siege directly helped Iraqi forces prevent the suicide bombing of the French embassy. Among those arrested was Huthaifa al-Batawi, the leader of the Islamic State of Iraq and main planner of the church siege.
The humanitarian condition in Afghanistan has worsened this year and is likely to degenerate further in 2011, according to Jacob Kellenberger, president of the Red Cross. Civilian casualties have risen, and millions of Afghans living in rural regions have been unable to attain a basic level of health care this year. Kellenberger stated that only a political solution is likely to stymie the deteriorating humanitarian condition. The Red Cross has asked for a 12% increase in its budget from donors, a total of 1.2 billion Swiss francs. Afghanistan is expected to be the largest item on its budget for the second straight year and will likely cost 89 million Swiss francs.
Missions run by special force units in Iraq are down to half of what they were annually since 2008, partially because of a drop in violence, according to a U.S. military official. Colonel Darcy D. Rogers, Jr. stated that the average missions per week has dropped from 50 in the last 2 years to 25. Numbers released by Iraqi ministries this week support the U.S. claim that there have been lower levels of violence in the country. Colonel Mark Mitchell attributed the decrease in counterterrorism missions to more rigorous legal requirements. Since January 2009, counterterrorism operations must attain authorization from Iraqi judges by supplying sufficient evidence to obtain an arrest warrant for suspects.
A British aid worker kidnapped by the Taliban was killed by American special forces during a hostage rescue attempt, according to the British government. The UK's Foreign Minister William Hague says 36-year-old Linda Norgrove died from a grenade thrown by American soldiers attempting to defend their position. A British and U.S. military investigation showed that initially, American forces reported Norgrove had died from a suicide bomber due to a Taliban fighter found dead next to her. Video of the incident later revealed a flash from a grenade at their location, confirming the actual cause of Norgrove's death. Mr. Hague stated that disciplinary action had been taken against rescue members for not providing a complete account of their actions in the mission.
A hearing has begun for David Lawrence, an army private accused of the premeditated murder of a Taliban commander. Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who has often denounced NATO's use of force, called the act an assassination and demanded that the U.S. conduct a comprehensive investigation. The focus of the trial will be on Lawrence's mental health. Lawrence sought medical help for depression, anxiety, and sleeplessness days before the shooting and was taking antidepressants. His family has a history of schizophrenia, and he had been hearing voices, as he told his parents in multiple emails. The defense will argue he was not fit to be in active duty in the first place and is not mentally fit to testify. The trial is expected to shed light on the U.S. military's dealings with mental illness.
Amazon Incorporated has stopped WikiLeaks from using its servers to disseminate sensitive State Department documents. Senator Joe Lieberman stated that the move occurred after Amazon was asked by congressional staff about its activities with WikiLeaks. Recently, WikiLeaks came under an internet-based attack, causing it to move onto Amazon Web Services, which rents out server space. After being booted from Amazon, WikiLeaks moved back to its previous Swedish host, Bonafab, within a few hours. Senator Lieberman condoned Amazon's ousting of WikiLeaks and encouraged other companies not to help WikiLeaks distribute illegally seized materials. Amazon has remained silent on its relationship to WikiLeaks.
The U.S. has introduced a new weapon for use in Afghanistan. The XM-25 rifle uses new technology that commands its ammunition to explode before or after the target. The new technology means that targets can no longer take cover behind walls. The XM-25 rifle has a range of about 2,300 feet, much longer than any of the carbines and rifles carried by most soldiers today. U.S. military officials are not worried about the new weapons being stolen or copied, since the rifle requires a kind of ammunition that's difficult to acquire, and the technology needed to develop the weapon itself is expensive. This is War News Radio. President Obama declared the end of combat missions in Iraq during an Oval Office address in August, saying the U.S. had met its obligation in that country. But one American soldier remains missing in action, and his family is still waiting for answers. Jeremy Rappaport-Stein spoke with relatives in both countries.
U.S. Army Sergeant Ahmed Altai had left the Green Zone to visit his new Iraqi wife in Baghdad when he was abducted. Several hours later, his ex-wife and close friend, Linda Racy, heard the news.
His mother had called me at about 11:30 at night on the night of October 23rd of 2006. I received a telephone call, and his mother was hysterical that her son was kidnapped.
Sergeant Altai, an Iraqi-American translator from Ann Arbor, Michigan, was abducted in Baghdad sometime after 4:30 p.m. on that Monday afternoon. 4 years later, he remains missing, and many questions, including what will happen in light of the end of combat missions in Iraq, remain unanswered. One of these questions is how Sergeant Altai was able to leave the Green Zone, the headquarters of U.S. military operations in Iraq.
And he went to go visit his wife, thinking he could blend in with the rest of the Iraqi population. And as soon as he arrived at her home, at a time that they had both agreed that he would be there, he didn't even pull up to her front on the street in the Karada district of Iraq, which is where she lives in Karada, and the kidnappers had thrown him into the back of a vehicle right at that moment.
According to an Associated Press report at the time, four men dressed all in black except for white masks covering their faces dragged Altai from the home of his in-laws, handcuffed him, threw him in the back of their car, and drove off. The fact that this happened while Sergeant Altai was outside the Green Zone on personal business is a source of some surprise and confusion. According to Steve Valley, a former Green Zone public information officer and author of Inside the Fortress, A Soldier's Life in the Green Zone, the idea of a soldier getting out to visit his wife seems strange.
When I was there, there was virtually no way, unless you were decepting somebody, that you could get out of the Green Zone, nor any other military forward operating base.
But according to Valley, deceiving the extensive American security at the Green Zone is a nearly impossible task.
It would be extremely difficult. First of all, you have local Iraqis working the gates for civilians, and that's another checkpoint, another level of security where they ask for IDs, and then you also have the American military, who are the main keepers of the Green Zone, asking for IDs.
Valley said that when soldiers leave the green zone, they don't leave on foot.
I mean, you were going into the red zone, which was like the OK Corral. I mean, you were locked and loaded. You were driving in armored up vehicles. You had full battle rattle on. Your cargo pockets were filled with rounds of ammunition. And I mean, you know, the red zone was not a safe area, so it wasn't taken lightly to implement different levels of security. So this certainly was not something easy that this soldier supposedly had done. I mean, if he did it that way, it was well planned and well thought out.
If Sergeant Altai had been caught leaving the green zone without authorization, there would be disciplinary consequences.
That would probably be a non-judicial punishment, what you've commonly referred to as a Article 15.
Okay.
That's handled at the unit level between the immediate chain of command. I mean, and that's not a definitive answer. I mean, if he came out and said he snuck off base and was out visiting locals, the unit command, of course, could refer that to a JAG officer, and they could proceed with with court-martial proceeding.
Despite the fact that his actions may have warranted disciplinary action were he not kidnapped, Ahmed Altai was promoted from a specialist to a sergeant in the wake of his abduction. The press releases at the time did not detail how it came to be that a soldier was outside the green zone on personal business. Another missing link in the story is who took Sergeant Altai to begin with. After he was abducted, the Army launched a massive search to find Sergeant Altai. The effort, however, was unsuccessful. At first, all signs pointed to the Mahdi Army, a radical Shiite militia created by cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The area in which Sergeant Altai was kidnapped is dominated by the militia group, and a video of Sergeant Altai was posted to a pro-Sadr website in 2007, intended to prove that he was still alive. Entifad Kanbar, Ahmed Altai's uncle and a prominent Iraqi politician, was involved in the effort to try and find him. Kanbar says that he's not convinced.
Well, the story is mixed up. I mean, you have to understand that Mahdi Army is not a disciplined, clear organization. Anybody, it's basically an army of volunteers, and that could be very fluid. And there is no clear structure for this army. The Mahdi Army themselves, people who I've known in the Mahdi Army, disowned them, and they said they have been not being part of the Mahdi Army. On the others say no, they were not Mahdi Army, but some other special Shia groups. That was the main issue for Ahmed. It was not very clear who has gotten him, and everybody says, we know of him, but we are not the party or the entity which have him. And that has a lot to do with the chaotic nature of these militias.
Part of the problem of finding where Sergeant Altai is and figuring out who is responsible for his kidnapping is that the story of the abduction goes beyond the people who grabbed him off the streets.
I mean, the people who executed the process, the kidnapping, they have been arrested and they are in prison. I even made an appeal to the court to lighten their sentence because the punishment for kidnapping in Iraq is execution. And I tried to convince the court to reduce their sentence to life in prison or something less than execution in return for their cooperation to find Ahmed. I think they did cooperate, but I think the fact that they have been imprisoned so long, they lost touch about his whereabouts.
Ahmed Altai has been gone for over 4 years now. From the looks of it, we still don't know precisely who was responsible for his abduction, where he is now, or how he managed to leave the heavily fortified green zone. What is certain is that his family and friends would like to see the story come to an end.
I myself wish to see Mr. Altai back alive to his family and to his mother and father, but I also would like to see a closure to this catastrophe and to this miserable days. And I will believe, I will accept whatever God's will, even if he's dead, to bring a closure to his situation. But I also, naturally, I would not believe he's dead until I see 100% proof of his proof of his death. And if he's alive, that will be a serious miracle.
While reporting this story, War News Radio contacted multiple military and government sources, including the Army Office of Public Affairs, the U.S. Embassy in Iraq, and the Michigan National Guard. All requests for information were either declined, delayed, or referred to a non-responsive third party. According to the last press release concerning this case on the Department of Defense website, efforts continue to obtain the successful and safe return of Altai. That was December 14th, 2006. For War News Radio, I'm Jeremy Rappaport-Stein.
This is War News Radio. A Pentagon report was released this week that supports the repeal of the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. In the premier segment of a new media analysis series, Karim Sarikhmed delves into how media sources have covered this new information.
This past Tuesday, the Pentagon released a report based on a survey of what about 100,000 troops think about gays in the military. It found that 70% believe that letting openly gay individuals serve would have little to no effect on the U.S. military's effectiveness, and that 69% already served with someone who they believed was gay anyway. These findings were leaked a few weeks ago, but many legislators as well as military personnel refused to comment on the report or act on it until it was released officially. But the fact that the report was not yet officially released certainly didn't discourage the media from speculating as to its repercussions. Ed O'Keefe and Greg Jaffe of the Washington Post said that the report would spark a heated and partisan congressional debate. 4 days after the Veterans Day leak, Politico reported on a small movement for the early release of the leaked report, driven by Democratic Senator Joe Lieberman and Republican Senator Susan Collins, as well as Human Rights Campaign, a group dedicated to gay rights advocacy. That movement was unsuccessful, but now, a few days after the report's release, there clearly is a divide in the political atmosphere as well as in the media. On Tuesday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates expressed a belief that Don't Ask, Don't Tell is a flawed policy, which is inconsistent with some of the U.S. military's most fundamental values. Here's some of what he had to say.
A policy or a law that, in effect, requires people to lie gives me a problem. We spend a lot of time in the military talking about integrity and honor and values. Telling the truth is a pretty important value in that scale. It's a very important value. And so for me, a policy that requires people to lie about themselves somehow seems to me fundamentally flawed.
NPR reported that Republican Senators Scott Brown and Susan Collins seem open to supporting the policy's repeal. However, currently on the Fox News website's U.S. military page, in 18-point font, is the title McCain and Others Say Military Gays Study is Biased. It's an Associated Press report on Republican Senator John McCain's opposition to the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, and his skepticism concerning the Pentagon survey. He suggested that the survey should have asked whether troops wanted Don't Ask, Don't Tell to be repealed or not. Secretary Gates said that such a question would pretty much amount to a military referendum, when such policy decisions really need to be made by Congress or in court. Meanwhile, on MSNBC's U.S. military page is a syndicated article from Reuters about the health concerns of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It cites commentary from the New England Journal of Medicine that says soldiers unwilling to give candid information about their sexual histories could mean a failure to diagnose sexually transmitted diseases like AIDS. The controversy over this issue is most clearly visible in a video on the BBC's website. The End features footage of Daniel Choi, an openly gay former infantry officer who has been at the forefront of recent opposition to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The footage is of Choi and other protesters standing in front of the White House shouting, "I am somebody!" Then Choi gets pinned to the ground and carried away by four policemen. The interesting thing here is not only that the video foreshadows a struggle over the issue, but that the protest footage is from this past spring, and the BBC, in a way, is still promoting the message of Choi's protest months after the fact by choosing it as an image to represent the controversy. For War News Radio with Anjali Kadambi and Kate Aronoff, I'm Kerim Sari Ahmed.
This is War News Radio. Specialist Brad Kenny has been deployed to Iraq twice as a member of the Pennsylvania Army National Guard. We spoke with him about his memories of the two tours he spent in Iraq and his hopes as he adjusts back to life in the U.S. Jared Nolan has the story. This piece first aired in March.
Brad Kenny's first tour was from 2005 to 2006 in the city of Habaniya, a little over 50 miles west of Baghdad.
I'm a combat medic. So my job was to take care of the troops on the ground in case they got injured. Think of it as an EMT on scene at all times, except I had a rifle.
As a combat medic, most of his time was spent out in the city on missions.
So our main deal was going out and finding weapons caches. Finding them, destroying them in place if we had to, or bringing them back for the ordnance disposal people to blow up. I don't have the exact numbers, but we found a lot. We found more than our active duty predecessors, which I'm proud to say, because we were all National Guard. Found a few IEDs and quite a few weapons caches.
Habaniya is a predominantly Sunni area, and Brad felt the Iraqis were less friendly there than they were on his second tour in Sababur.
The second tour, we were in a Shia area, and they seemed to be more pro-U.S. I don't know what they were like when we left, but overall, they were more in favor of us being there. The Sunni, not so much. And the first tour was in a solidly Sunni area.
Overall, though, Brad found Iraqis surprisingly accommodating.
One thing I have to say about the Iraqi people, no matter who they are, whether they're pro-U.S., anti-U.S., or they don't really care either way, they're very hospitable. I mean, I don't know if I would offer tea and fresh-baked bread to people who came into my house to set up an observation post, whether I thought that they were okay or not. I don't know if I'd still like it. The Iraqis would actually make us tea, bake us bread, bring it to us as we're sitting on their roof with weapons.
Brad tried to return the favor whenever he could. On his second tour, he came across a mother who was too sick to leave her house. Months earlier, she had gone to a clinic and was advised to go to the hospital, but she wanted to stay at home because her daughters were still in school.
And by the time school was out, she was too sick to go back to the clinic, which was the only way to get an ambulance ride where we were at. There was nothing really to do for her there. She needed to go to hospital. You know, it was way past the combat medic level. But when we got back to the JSS, I pretty much browbeat the Iraqi police into going and picking her up. Never found out what exactly happened. It's kind of hard to follow up, but they swore that they would go out and get her, and we showed them where the house was on a map, so I can really, really hope for.
Still, action like that was rare. Brad found he had a lot of spare time on his hands.
Have you ever seen those old war movies where the guys, they get home, and Jimmy on the street says, "Hey, what was the war like?" And then they say, "Well, it was 99% boredom, 1% sheer terror." Yeah, that's pretty much what it's like. 99% of the time, you're sitting there, you don't know what to do with yourself. I mean, you've got your job to do, but it's just so repetitive, so boring, that you think you're going to go crazy. And then a teeny, teeny little sliver of the time, you're scared out of your wits because something's happening. I mean, you still maintain your composure, but you've got that adrenaline going, your heart's pumping a mile a minute.
With a lot of downtime, the soldiers found various ways to amuse themselves. Brad told me this story about the puddles of excrement he encountered on his second tour.
Poo oceans is what we call them. We actually had them on the map, Poo Ocean 1 through Poo Ocean 6. You could throw a cinder block in them and it would just disappear. with a big smelly sploop, you know. Open sewers everywhere. So that's kind of nasty, trudging around that stuff, and you're trying not to to walk in it, and you're driving your vehicles through them. You know, we had one guy, I swear, he just tried to, his goal was to drive through all the poop puddles in our town. And, you know, we had to ride in these things, and the drivers had to clean them up and whatnot, so everyone, we loved them, but, you know, you wanted to kill them, you know, for getting poop everywhere.
Now that Brad is back in the States, he is facing more somber challenges. At times, his transition back to civilian life has been trying.
Second time's been a bit more difficult. More jumpy than before. Get angrier quicker.
The difficulties also extended to employment issues.
Finding a job was pretty hard. I was working with the National Guard before I deployed as a career counselor. Great program. It was a retention-based program. You know, your goal was to keep soldiers in the military, in the National Guard in this case, and you did it by being a career counselor, by helping them out with their career militarily, helping them go to school. A lot of these people joined the National Guard to go to school, but never used their benefits.
But the program was cut once the Army started scaling back.
The Army's budget was cut, and so the Army cut recruiting and retention. And so recruiting and retention cut retention. Because with the tough economic times, maybe that paycheck once a month is enough keeping you in.
Once the program ended, Brad started looking for a full-time job. When he could not find something that paid decently, he started taking classes for teacher certification and looked for part-time work.
Found a part-time job. I actually work at the VA Insurance Center up on Wishicken Avenue. Nice place, nice people. And the GI Bill, along with that, is covering what we need to cover. And the wife works full-time. And I've got 2 years left. Well, 1.5 years left in the military. Then I'm going to get out, and I'll have done my service and for king and country. Get to wear my cool little veteran's hat and go do veterans things.
Watching the parades.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, parade's great. Wear all my little shiny medals.
For War News Radio, I'm Jared Nolan.
That's our show for this week. War News Radio is a production of Swarthmore College. Visit us online to listen to archived shows, learn more about the program, or subscribe to our podcast. That's at warnewsradio.org.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook to keep up with War News Radio between shows. Look for the links on our site.
Our behind-the-scenes crew this week includes Eliana Biscard Church, Kyle Crawford, Lewis Katz, Rosanna Kim, Jonathan Kwan, and Amandine Lee. I'm Kate Aronoff.
And I'm Anjali Kadambi. Until next time, thanks for listening.